today with Dr. K. I'm Dr. KY's Whitehead. Folks, it is the Weekly Wrap, and we are covering a number of things that are on the table. We've been talking about education, but I do want to make a note that we just got this huge screenshot that it's official that quarterback Joe Flacco has been traded to the Denver Broncos in exchange for a 2019 fourth-round pick. That's on the table. We can talk about this education scandal that's gotten me so uptight and concerned. We can talk about that. We can talk about the fact that Black women who have worked on the system trying to make sure their child gets a better education using a fake address, typically a family member, have ended up going to jail. Meanwhile, white folks are writing checks. And all of them were released on their own recognizance, which means they didn't have to pay any money and got released. We're talking about that today. Give me a call, 410-319-8888. I had Miss M on the phone. She was talking about her son, or I think her stepson, going to Woodlawn High School. Miss M, are you still with us?
I'm still here, yes.
We got to have the end of this story. So he was zoned for Woodlawn, which is, we know, one of the worst schools out there. And you said you did what you had to do to get him out of there. What did you do to get him out of there?
Well, after we looked into, you know, like a medical reason of, you know, traumatic stress syndrome, basically going to that particular school, they wanted, like the school board wanted documentation, months of doctor's visits, psychiatric notes, things like that, to prove that it was a stressful event going to that school. So we actually went to the residency director and spoke to him and explained everything. And he worked with us in order to get my youngest stepson into a different school. It was down to the wire where we were going to have to, like, withdraw him from the school for the school year until we can figure out where he was going to go to high school. So for Angela, maybe she doesn't know all the different challenges that parents have to go through. She's saying, you know, she would not break the law if she was a mother. I don't know if she is a mother.
Right.
But it's stressful here in this state trying to secure proper education for the children, for your children. So, and the fact that she would even suggest that going to a different area is better than going into the neighborhood. That is division of neighborhood. That does not improve unity amongst those. And there's something called de facto segregation and de jure segregation.
There you go. Talk about it. Talk about
it. Yes. And if you want to be segregated, like, I like hanging out with Black people. I'm a Black woman. I understand. I feel more comfortable with people who have shared my experience. And I want that for my son, too. I don't want him to have to go out of his comfort zone just to secure a proper education. And when I say comfort zone, I'm talking about safety. I don't want him to have to be around a bunch of white people. And I'm not trying to be racist or bigoted, but my son can't do everything that other white students can.
That's something that we have to deal with the reality of. Thank you so much,
Miss
M. I want to be clear, folks. Now, de facto, we talk about segregation. That segregation is in facto, in effect. It's not necessarily tied to the law. De jure segregation is what's written in the law. When we talk about legal segregation, that was de jure segregation. Today, when we talk about the fact that schools are now more segregated than they were in the 70s, that is de facto segregation. We have Derek on the phone. Now, Derek is an alum of Woodlawn High School, and he wanted to respond to Miss M. Derek, how are you?
Oh, I'm great. I'm great, Dr. K.
So talk to me here. I got you calling. Miss M got you calling.
I'm very much so concerned and upset about the response to Woodlawn High School. I understand, just based on my experience and interaction with it as of late, that it seems like most of the teachers they put in Woodlawn are most of the younger teachers or the inexperienced teachers. Mm-hmm. Now, I've got a few friends of mine whose kids have graduated from Woodlawn who've gone on to graduate from college. One kid was an IT major. I got a full ride to Frostburg State University. He's done very well. So I don't know. It depends on the individual. I mean, I'm a product of Woodlawn. I eventually went to college. You know, I'm an architect. Matter of fact, I know we have an astronaut that graduated from Woodlawn.
My question is, how long ago, though? I'm not challenging you on this. I'm just saying, how long ago?
I'm going to say it was a while ago. But I'm going to say, realistically, you know, the schools are, I guess you get out what you put in. And just to keep it honest and upfront, my son went to a private school.
Okay.
You know, you was questioning where you want to send your son.
Yeah.
You got to figure out what's going to be best for your son. And based on my experience, I eventually sent my son to Gilman. He graduated from Gilman. He was accepted to every school he applied to.
Now,
and he applied to over 20 schools.
Well, let me ask. Let me just throw this out there.
The bottom line is,
hold on, Derek. Well, let me just throw this out, because you sent your son to Gilman, which I think, you know, was a very good choice. Gilman is, of course, the number two all boys private school in the country. We know that, and it's the number two private school in Maryland. So Gilman gets an A plus across the board, except in diversity, where they have an A minus. Woodlawn, which is where you went, which is where you chose not to send your son, the new niche grade for Woodlawn that just came out, they got a D plus. They got a C minus in academics, in teachers, college prep, health and safety. They got a C plus in clubs and a B in diversity. Their overall SAT score at Woodlawn is a 930. The average ACT is a 17 out of 34. The graduation rate is 89%, and less than 12% go on to AP courses. So I'm just saying, you sent your child on to Gilman, but the school you came from, it doesn't seem to be doing that well, at least on paper.
I'm going to say I personally have been trying to get involved with the PTA as an opportunity to reach back.
Right.
Because realistically, your kids are a product of your family and your community.
Yes, they are.
Now, I put a lot of time, energy, and effort into my son, and it paid off.
Yes.
You know, I went to a PTA meeting last night at another school in the county. There was 10 people at a PTA meeting.
Yeah.
And out of those 10, three of them was officers, and the other two was teachers and administrators.
So
you mean you tell me you got a school that got 900 kids in there, and you got five parents at the PTA meeting?
I'm just putting it down there. I'm just putting it down. Thank you so much, Derek. Folks, I mean, just think about this, right? I'm using Derek as an example, not picking on him. Derek went to Woodlawn. Miss M called and said that when she found out that her stepson was zoned to Woodlawn, they were upset. They did what they had to do. He stayed 1 year and they moved him. Derek called to challenge that. Hey, Derek's son went to Gilman, folks. I'm just saying. So he didn't send his son to a school that has a 47% proficiency in reading and a 56% proficiency in math, which means more than half the students at Woodlawn are not meeting at grade level for reading and math. Folks, these are real things. Our children, that is our future. How many of you are willing to take a gamble on your own child? I'm sorry, if it means breaking the law, and I'm only talking about breaking the law in terms of using a fake address or a family's address just so my child could go to a better school, how is that something that I should go to jail for? We have that clip. I think it's 6522. Let's go ahead and play that clip, and then we're going to go back to the phones.
Every parent wants to give their child the best education possible. One Ohio mom is currently sitting in jail, accused of illegally trying to get her daughters into a better school district. Should she be serving time, or was she justified? Our Andrew Canning is here with more on this mother's crime and her punishment here. This is going to really light up our message board.
Yeah, it is a big, big debate right now, Robin. Kelly Williams-Bowler is serving a 10-day sentence. She falsified residency records, and prosecutors say a private investigator even caught her red-handed on video living in the wrong district. Bowler says all she wanted to do was help her daughters escape their crime-ridden Akron neighborhood.
It's overwhelming. I'm exhausted. I did this for them, so there it is.
Kelly Williams-Bowler's decision to try to give her daughters a better life has now landed her behind bars. It started 4 years ago when Bowler, who lives in a poorer section of Akron, Ohio, sent her daughters to a highly ranked school in a neighboring district. The problem is, it wasn't her district, it was her father's, and her children weren't eligible to go there. She says she did it to keep them safe and that she lived part-time.
She did it just so she could give her children a better education. Now, folks, I'm not saying we need to break the law. I'm not saying that, okay? So don't go forward and say, Dr. K says, do what you have to do. I'm saying that I can understand where this mom is coming from. I'm saying I can be sympathetic. I'm saying I can be empathetic toward where this mom is coming from, being willing to do whatever you need to do to make sure your child has equal opportunities in this educational system. The latest research that just came out shows that black children within predominantly black environments receive far fewer dollars coming in the door per child. Additionally, and this is the one that got me, that black children attending these schools tend to not be properly prepared for college. These are schools where the majority of students are black. This came out from the Center for American Progress. It also noted that students of color get unequal course offerings. So what does that mean? The United States Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights revealed that 1/4 of schools with majority black and Latino enrollments do not offer Algebra 2. Which a student needs to keep going in math to get them ready for college. 1/3 of these schools don't even offer chemistry. Even though black and Latina kids are 40% of the population at schools that offered gifted programs, students from these backgrounds are only 26% of gifted enrollment. So black students who attend schools that have gifted and talented programs don't even get into them. Don't forget the study from the Baltimore Sun that just came out a couple of years ago, where they found that schools in the county have far fewer black children in the AP courses and the advanced courses than white students. They're willing to give white students an opportunity to try to do well, and they don't give that opportunity to black students. They think the work is, quote, too hard for them. We have Lance on the phone from Baltimore. Lance, how are you?
I'm great, Dr. K. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you for calling.
No problem. I actually had a couple things from, I guess, a few of the conversations you had this week. So, and they all, I guess, are intertwined. So I want to start with what you're talking about as far as, like, you know, I don't know, from a ground level of, like, the different neighborhoods in Baltimore City. I grew up in Edmondson Village up until I was about 6. And then my mother had us move to Ednor Gardens Lakeside, which is like basically the backyard or the front yard of Morgan State University.
Right.
And when she did that, it was two things that she did strategically. One, she put me down the street from Baltimore City College High School, which I eventually went to. But she also had me just within the the range of Roland Park Middle School.
Okay.
And I was completely outside of the of the zone by two streets.
Wow.
My best friend lived two streets up on El Cato. I lived three streets down, on Yolando, and he was in zone. I wasn't. So we used his address, and that, you know, that was no problem for a while, you know, at all. We never got caught or anything like that, mainly because we didn't tell anybody about anything, and we were the only two that went home the same way. But going from, I guess, a step further with that, before I left for middle school to go to Roland Park, I was at Waverly Elementary, which is, again, right down the street, which has recently been renovated and is a beautiful school now. But my point to make about that is that when I was going there, there really wasn't I didn't know anything about Baltimore City College High School when I was at Waverly Elementary, even though it was right down the street. I could see it from the school.
Right.
There wasn't really any follow-up or any connection. There was more of a prison-to-school pipeline than there was from a school-to-school pipeline, you know? And I guess to, like, talk about that a little bit more, or to relate it back to what we're talking about now,
right,
is that when I was at Baltimore City College High School, they had at least 3 or 4 levels of schooling. You had honors, which was regular school,
right,
technically, in comparison,
right,
to everybody else. Then you had AP, and then you had IB. AP and IB didn't really take off until maybe my 10th or 11th grade year, because they started to kind of move towards a mandatory, like, everybody's going to be IB. We're going to be the International Baccalaureate School, which was fine, except I didn't see the point in trying exceedingly harder for school when I knew for a fact that my mom didn't have money for me to go to school. I was going to the Navy, and I did go to the Navy. But one of the things that struck me when I was at the school was that they had a program for International Baccalaureate and AP classes, that if you were in that program, and mind you, the majority of that, and this was extremely segregated. All the honors classes were all black. You had maybe one white kid, you know, and then you had, you know, everybody else was in AP and IB, and, you know, classrooms the size of like 6 people, and,
right,
you know, 5 of those people are white, you know. And then moving, they had can't remember if it was during the summer or during spring break, but it was a trip where it was called the Civil Rights Trip. And I see both sides of the coin on this trip, but they would take all of the people from these IB and AP courses, which were majority white kids, on a civil rights trip through the South, retracing the steps of, like,
right.
you know.
I've heard of those kind of trips, too.
Right. And it's a great trip. But I felt like it was not wasted on these white kids, but it was stolen from these black kids that could have benefited in the sense of having a context of where they are now as opposed to where we were. And allowing us to, I guess, acquiesce to, you know, what our actual futures can be, rather than feeling as though, oh, these kids weren't smart enough to, or didn't apply themselves enough to get their own history.
Right.
You know what I mean?
So the idea that, but I just want to make sure that I'm clear on what you're saying. So with this, with everything you're saying, because I love that you laid out your story, do you think that this mother, and this is an old story, but it came back up because we were talking about this whole thing with, you know, the white people who are scamming the system. Do you think it's wrong for a mother to do exactly what your mother did, which is just use another address so that their child could have the opportunity that you had?
No. I mean, I still do it to this day. You know, CCBC Essex, you know, technically speaking, as far like at the time that I started going there, which was 2011, 2012, BCCC in Baltimore City was actually having problems with their accreditation to the point where they were going to lose their accreditation
right.
at one point. So I didn't want to waste my money there. So I was like, all right, let me go to Essex. So when I went to Essex, they was like, okay, well, this is how much the tuition is, and this is how much it is for people who live in this county. I was like, okay, well, I live in this county. Do I live in this county? No, but I'm going to find an address.
But you did what you had to do. So you can get, that's all I'm saying. All right, thank you so much. I appreciate you. Folks, when we talk about what this educational system looks like for our children, I think we have to be honest about it. If we can't write the check for $250,000, $400,000, which I cannot do, but I also don't want my child to not have opportunities for AP courses, to not have opportunities to take a foreign language, to not have an opportunity to have the resources. We've got to find a better way to do this. The system is deeply segregated and is set up against our children who are struggling and who are suffering. We have Doreen on the phone from Laurel, Maryland. Doreen, how are you?
I am great, Dr. K, and I am enjoying listening to you this afternoon.
Thank you.
I have 2 points. I'm going to be as quick as I can. My husband's father was head of the NAACP back in the 50s and 60s in North Carolina. When the schools were desegregated, he took all 6 of his 11 kids that were still in school, and they were the first ones to hit the white school.
Mm.
He put them right in there. My husband was a genius back then, is to this day. He has had white teachers in the first grade to change his scores so he would not be smarter than the little white boy that
Whoa.
Was in his class. His father showed up. There were black teachers in the school. They took care of business. I, meanwhile, grew up in New York. I was born in the projects. My parents were in the projects in Brooklyn. At 2 years old, they moved on up. They bought a house out in Long Island. We were the first black family on the block. I personally saw white flight. Within a year, it was an all-black neighborhood. The school was all black. My sister, bullying is nothing new. She was beat up every single day. She saw the schools and everything go down. She used my cousin's address that was in another district
right.
and transferred all of us to what we call the white school. In the white school, I took glee club. I took art. I saw white
wow.
people that I never saw before. And we stayed there until I moved to North Carolina. When I got married and met my husband, we moved up to Gaithersburg when my children were young. Gaithersburg was where the melting pot. Every one of my daughter's friends to this day are Asian. They're Middle Eastern. They're African. They're black.
Right.
My daughters went through Morgan because, again, my daughter would be the only black child. But now she's not
right.
just with white people. She's competing with Asian people who come here and purposely put their kids in the middle of it all.
Yeah.
And she had to compete with that, and she did. She had full rides to many colleges, but she took Morgan because she wanted to go to a historically black college. It was a whole nother education.
Nice. Yes.
My thing is, my husband and I often have these conversations because, like you said, this is nothing new. We know the system
yeah,
is set up
new.
For us
yep.
to fail. But we have a diamond in the rough in the system. My husband, he doesn't know if it can work. I don't. These, because he went through the North Carolina University school system, he had a scholarship to NC State, but instead he chose North Carolina A&T. My daughter sees the comparison between her going to Morgan and what Towson
right.
University
oh, yes.
has. all of our young black athletes that are completely supporting these boosters and putting billions of dollars into UNC, Chapel Hill, North Carolina State, any kind of top 10 basketball university teams, those are our sons that are pulling that money in. I told my husband, suppose at the high school level, at the junior high school level, when we see our diamonds in these athletes, we guide them. Yes, you may not be on television the first few years, but if our historically black colleges
recruit our young men,
they will come to us.
Yes, they will.
We don't have to come to them. It's going to take a sacrifice because these boys, they want the NBA.
And their families want that, which I understand.
And their families.
Yes.
That's right. But it's a sacrifice. Now, that is where we might not be able to change the system right now, but we can make the system come to us because in the end, money talks.
All right, I got to stop you there. Thank you so much. I got to stop you there. I have Tessa on the phone, a new call from Owens Mill. Tessa, how are you? And welcome to the family.
I'm good. And thank you so much, Dr. K, and I appreciate you taking my call.
So
what I wanted to talk about, I'm going through a similar situation now with my son in middle school. And the truth of the matter is the schools are different, and parents wouldn't have to be dishonest about using other addresses of the family members so their child can go to another district if all the schools offer the same opportunities. You know, every parent wants their child afforded, you know, a healthy and wealthy education. However, it's not that way. So, you know, we have to be realistic. Now, my son went to a school that was outside of his district because they didn't offer the program that he needed in his school because he has an IEP. And I had to fight so hard I eventually got to the point where I told him, if you all can't help him, then give me some options at some other schools that do have the programs to help him. We're not going to sit here and just house him and just pass him along.
Right.
So when they did give me the school, then the school was out of the district, and I was so overwhelmed. I could not believe the quality of the education that they had at their school.
Wow.
And what he was getting in his own community school, he was able to get involved in the music. They had foreign language in the elementary school. I mean, he really took off. His grades really skyrocketed. When he graduated there, he was at grade level. Whereas the other school, they were saying, oh, he would never do this and never do that, which kind of, you know, really made me angry. Because you're telling me my son would never do that. To me, you never put never when you're talking about a child.
I know. I got to stop you there, Tessa. I really appreciate you sharing that story and fighting for your child. Folks, we have one shot with our children. You're talking K-12. If you're not giving them the best opportunities at that level, it is setting them up either for a world of opportunity to be open to them or for the doors to be closed. Like, it's really on us at this point, and we got to be able to push. I'm going to hold it here for just a moment. This is Today with Dr. K. I'm Dr. K. Wise Whitehead. When I come back, I have Davon Love in the studio with me from Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. Let's hold these council members accountable. We're going to talk about that more when we return. Welcome back to Today with Dr. K. I'm Dr. K. Wise Whitehead. Folks, last night, Dr. Lawrence Brown, who many of you know, he's at Morgan State. He does a lot of work looking at the black butterfly and the white owl. He was also on the Roots list of 100 most influential black folks in America. He dropped this chart on Facebook that had people going crazy. And it was a chart to show which elected Baltimore City Council members consistently vote for social justice and racial equity. It was color-coded, and it says the name of every single council person. And because it was so shocking, we wanted to have some discussion about this. We reached out to Dr. Lawrence Brown. He has class today. And so we got the person who was right at the top of our list as well, Davon Love from Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. Davon, how are you, sir?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so now there are three things that he put on the list, and I want to first have you just kind of explain why he chose these and drill down deep for social justice and racial equity. The first one was the veto override for the $15 minimum wage.
Mm-hmm. So let me just give an overview. The three things that were included in the chart was the veto override for the $15 minimum wage, the mandatory minimum bill that went through the city council a couple years ago, and then the source of income the source of income bill that would make it so that the source of income wasn't something that renters would use in applications for people that are applying for housing. And so I think it's important. So in terms of why he chose those three, I think those are three good things that are good as indexes for council people's voting record on issues that talk about poverty in particular. I think the gun bill is criminal justice, and so that actually overlaps more, in addition to poverty, talking more about the way that racism and white supremacy, you know, specifically operates as a matter of policy. But I think the other two are more about addressing efforts around anti-poverty. And I think Baltimore generally does have a history in terms of policies that don't invest in programs that address anti-poverty. So what Dr. Brown created was a chart where he selected those three indexes of what would constitute social justice, and then had a list of, you know, council people and their voting record on those particular bills. And I think it's useful because I think most people don't have readily available the ability to just look at a chart that has issues they care about and say, like, you know, where they voted on it. And so I think, you know, in that regard, it's good. The thing that I will say, one of the things that LBS actually talked about in the report card we produced about the state legislature.
We had you on the show about that. We had Adam on the show.
Absolutely. Yes. And so one of the things that is important for people looking at it to know is that votes isn't always the best metric at getting a total picture of that person's record. And the reason why I'm saying, and I'm not saying that to refute what Dr. Brown put on the chart, but I'm saying it because I think it's important for people who are looking for information to get a real context of all the things you're looking for. So one of the things you look for are votes. Mm-hmm. The other things you look for is the commentary of that council person during committee hearings,
okay.
Questions that they ask city agencies when looking at what the administration does. Because one thing about Baltimore City is that we are a mayor, so we have a strong mayor system. So council people actually aren't the kinds of policymakers that you might find in a system where council people actually have more legislative leeway and power, right? And so oftentimes council people are in positions where a big part of the work they're doing is actually acting as a watchdog for the administration and asking questions about the nature of how the administration rolls things out.
Okay.
And so one of the things is actually that's new, or new-ish, is that Charm TV televises, records, and it's on YouTube, committee hearings right. on various issues. So on the bills that Dr. Brown put on the chart, I would actually advise the listeners to go and look for the committee hearings, if it goes back that far, on those bills to hear what their council people said on those issues, because I think that's important. And then some of the other things that you can miss also is one of the things that council people do is they negotiate with the administration on things like bond bills, right? Capital right. improvement projects. Yeah. And so you want to get a sense of, you know, what kinds of bond bills are they trying to bring back to the district and what part of the district are they bringing back bond bills for? So, for instance, if you're, you know, in the 5th Councilmanic District, you know, that's Schleifer,
right?
Who's in that district. You know, one thing that you would want to look for is he able to bring bond bills back that go for above Park Heights, above right. Northern Parkway, or below Northern Parkway? Right. That's right. a question of racial equity that you would want to look for.
Okay.
That, again, a vote wouldn't necessarily give you that total picture. It gives you enough to, I think, be able to know what kind of questions to ask. And so I think what Dr. Brown did was good in giving people a good starting point, because then based on the marks, you can then start asking questions. Well, what are some of the other things that these, you know, legislators or council people are doing toward the end of social justice?
Well, it made us go back and pull the people's records.
Right.
So the one that shocked us, for example, we just had Leon Pinkett on the show.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing this new segment called Mapping Baltimore Neighborhood by Neighborhood, where we're saying that we can't seem to find an answer for how to deal with everything in Baltimore, so we'll drill down on each neighborhood. And we started with Sandtown Winchester for obvious reasons. But then we saw Mr. Pinkett's record that he voted against a veto override for the $15 minimum wage.
Mm-hmm.
He voted in support of mandatory minimum sentences around gun possessions,
mm-hmm.
and he voted in support of this idea of the source of income discrimination. Well,
right.
those three things right there seem to be in complete opposition to this notion of working to build up your district in an equitable way. Like, it was very concerning.
And so one of the things, so using Councilman Pickett as an example, you know, a lot of people that know his history knows that he used to work at the Baltimore Development Corporation, right? So he's a development guy. And so him being a development guy, I imagine a part of his rationale for his votes have to do with his perspective and paradigm on development. So looking at the source of income, looking at the $15 minimum wage, one of the things that I think is important for the listeners to ask and to push their council people on is what is the nature of their own political relationships and how might that shape, you know, the kinds of votes they took? Okay. Because knowing Councilman Pickett's background, I kind of figured he was going to vote the way he did on the source of income piece and on the $15 minimum wage.
Which, by the way, was one of the bills he put up on the floor. That's a surprise. How do you put this and co-sponsor it, and then when it's time to override the mayor, that's the veto override, you completely move away. I thought, I was like, well, it must be something with the mayor, and you don't want to go against the mayor, and having you explain that we're not that type of city, where you have the strong council members, and they can just do their own thing, that it really is a mayor-driven city.
There are other municipalities where if council people work together, they can actually, you know, have power that is different than what we have in Baltimore. So, for instance, like the budget, the way the budget works in Baltimore is the mayor presents the budget. The council can either vote it up or down.
Right.
Now, the council, in some cases, people have argued that the council should be able to add line items. So our current council can't even add line items. The best they can do is delete line items if they vote on it collectively.
Right.
And so a part of the issue is that, like you mentioned, just because we have the strong mayor system, it creates a context where really the administration controls the discourse and controls the kind of policymaking landscape. And back to using, again, Councilman Pinkett as an example, you know, we should then ask ourselves, do we want people who are elected officials that are connected to the development world?
Right.
What does that mean about what a person will vote on based on the fact that they come from a development background? Now, there's some people that would say, well, you know, it's important that we have a development perspective because we want to ensure black people get in on economic development. Right. We want to make sure black people get contracts and the like. And so for me, that's probably the argument that Councilman Pinkett would put forward. I think it's important. And the reason why I'm giving this level of explanation is because part of sometimes what I worry about is the way that people create caricatures about a person's ideas without really understanding the context for it, right? Because if a person were to look at the chart and say, oh, he just must not care about black people, that's an intellectually lazy way to look at it, right? And so the question is, well, what would Councilman Pickett say about why he voted on those things so that we actually have an understanding of what the disagreement about? And what the disagreement is about is the nature of economic development. Should economic development be based on big misses and developers? Or should we require more of big businesses and developers to make sure that, you know, poor people and most vulnerable people are taken care of?
Right, which is on one end, except that when we think about things like the $15 minimum wage, and you think of things like mandatory, you know, minimum sentences, but then you look at the communities, right? So this is what got me, right? So I agree with you. I don't want people to be intellectually lazy. You got to do the work, people. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, if I line these things up and I go straight to the district and say, wait a minute, you are over a district where the issues that are talked about are actually impacting your direct community. Now, if you were over Mount Washington, I can see how you don't care about $15 minimum wage. I mean, because that's not something your people are calling for.
Mm-hmm.
Mandatory sentences. No, they want more sentences. They really want more in certain communities. But he's over Sandtown, Winchester, for example. I'm like, why wouldn't you want to have more money coming into a community that is economically challenged? I looked at, you know, John Bullock, who, by the way, has voted across the board on these things, which, as you said, doesn't necessarily mean that he's in complete support. Mm-hmm. But just looking at this as a chart does give you cause to kind of think about, who are you electing? Who's representing us?
Right. And again, I think the important piece is, what is their answer to the concerns that are put forward by this chart,
right?
And again, we have to ask ourselves, is that sufficient? So, like, one of the things that I would take issue with, again, we're using Councilman Pickett as an example. You know, one of the things I would take issue with is that we have to demand more from the business community and from the development community.
Right.
We have to demand more. So the fact that they don't want to support a $15 minimum wage, we have to demand more from the business community. Right. And so the issue that you would get back is, well, they'll leave if you make the business community, and that's what the business community does. They threaten to say, if you make us do this $15 minimum wage, well, then that's going to cost us, that's going to make us have to pay more money for things, and then we're just going to leave and go somewhere else because it's going to be cheaper to go somewhere else. That's the rationale they use. We, I think, as an informed citizenry, have to be armed with the arguments to combat that, right, and elect people who understand our perspective. That you know, in conversation, are not going to be dismissed as, oh, you're just a progressive lefty and that's just, you know, a thing you believe in. That you can actually say, no, I get what you're going to say. You're going to say business is going to leave. And what I'm going to say is, no, they actually can't leave because they need this base. They need, right, this economic base to be sustainable. Let's make them do more.
All right, we want to get some callers in here. 410-319-8880. I'm talking to Davon Love from Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. And what we're doing, we're really talking about how we can, A, hold our council members accountable, B, how can we use their record to just kind of make some predictions about where they're going, and C, how we can do the hard work so we can be prepared for the upcoming election. Folks, we got to vote with knowledge in hand. We have Nicole on the phone, a new caller from Windsor Mill. Nicole, how are you? Welcome to the family.
I'm fine. Thank you for taking my call.
Absolutely.
I actually can kind of relate what I wanted to discuss in regards to the school with what your panel member just talked about. I think when it comes into our council members, it's kind of like in relation to the schools and our children, it would be beneficial for the council people to actually be mindful that we're talking now about the possibility of allowing our youth to start voting at 16.
Right.
So if that's the case, we need to be mindful that they're going to impact getting them into office, which in turn would mean that they may want to consider with, like we heard the other day, Baltimore City's Youth Works program has over 12,000 or 16,000 kids that registered to try to work for the summer. That goes toward economic development.
Right.
In regards to like the minimum wage. If we want to see our children not end up in the same generational curses as their family members and want them to be successful, then we need to promote the higher wages so that they can see what they need to do in regards to savings and things like that. So in regards to the school conversation, that ties into that because one thing that would be beneficial in our schools is the financial literacy piece.
Right.
When we talk about the schools, and just to go back a little bit to your previous conversation, I actually have three children, and I've seen a digression in the school systems in Baltimore County since my oldest, who is now 20, has gone to school. One thing that impacted me the most, we were in a school district where the school was not the best. I had to pull my oldest, who was on an IEP plan, out of his middle school for in fear of him having altercations on a daily basis,
okay,
because he went to a predominantly white school. And he had to interact with people that he grew up with all of his life, because literally what they do in that county, and I know that it's relational to other parts of Baltimore County, the kids stay together all the way from elementary school, sometimes to high school, because of the zoning.
Okay, I'm going to stop you there. Nicole, I appreciate you. We have the real Thomas on the phone from Catonsville. Thomas, how are you?
Hey, I'm doing great. I was wondering if people were going to call in and try to filibuster to get away from the voting issue that you guys are talking about. Listen, Leon Pinkett, okay? You have to know a little bit more about Mr. Pinkett's background. Mr. Pinkett was a paid snitch to be in city politics back during the Stephanie Rollins Blake administration, and it is true that he worked for the Baltimore Development Corp
Okay, so now we know about, I have Davon Love here, and so we know about the Baltimore Development Corporation because we've all mentioned that. In terms of the paid snitch, we need to, I'm going to have you hold on, Thomas. We need to get some information on that. We need to get some documentation. You got to show the receipts for that, because to just kind of throw out there that an elected council person was a paid snitch, I'm not saying it couldn't happen. I'm not saying it didn't happen. I'm saying in order for us to go forward as if it did happen, we need some receipts on that, Thomas. So let's get those receipts. We'll get back to you. We have Dwayne on the phone from Baltimore City. Dwayne, how are you?
I'm good. Just happy to be here, Doctor. Just happy to be here. Hey, I have not seen this chart, but I'm very curious to look at it in reference to, you know, our council members and their voting record. But here's the challenge with what your guest is speaking on. Unfortunately, we live in a world now where, if you have a over nuanced position, then you're gonna get ignored, you know. And what I'm saying is that people aren't going to look all the way back to someone's voting record, and they're not going to
right.
see what their background. They're not gonna do that because we don't live in a world like that anymore. We live in a world where the politics are so fast and so quick that, you know, you have to make simple kind of one stage things for people to look at, get the message, and keep it moving, because we just don't live in a world anymore where nuance, unfortunately, you know, is something that we engage ourselves in politically. It's politics is fast, it's quick, and that chart is probably just as hurtful as it is helpful, because it is going to paint people in one light, because right. people aren't going to go and do this extensive research to try to elevate, you know, their thought processes about the person.
All right, thank you so much, Dwayne. So I'm going to come back to you, Davon, because, mm-hmm. you know, you have this chart. Again, it was, for a lot of people who follow Dr. Brown, first of all, it's the first time he's put up something in a while, because I know he's been working on his book. And so people stopped. The conversation was flying last night, but it also painted some people in a very good light, right? So I want to get people, just so they'll know. So when it comes to Councilman Burnett and Councilman Dorsey, District 8, District 3, Councilwoman Sneed from District 13, Councilwoman Mary Pat Clark from District 14, Councilman Zeke Berzoff Cohen from District 1, and Councilman John Bullock on one of the things. But from Zeke Cohen on up, all of them across the line seem to be in support of social justice and equity. Is that a fair assessment?
I think, like the previous caller made a very important point, which is that to a certain extent, the list that Dr. Brown used is an arbitrary one, right?
He picked, that's why there's three things.
He picked three things that, for him, probably based on the work that he's doing, makes the most sense for the things that's in his purview.
Right.
But to the last caller's point that I think is very important is that there are a whole host of other things that aren't on that list that are as important, that don't kind of paint the total universe of things to really assess, like what makes a council person kind of a stellar council person as it relates to racial justice. And again, I want your listeners to really understand the importance that looking at a person's voting record is one piece of it.
Right.
But there are a bunch of other things, particularly as – so, for instance, the caller before last, when the sister was talking about schools and one of the council people – see, one of the things with that is that that's actually a conversation for your state legislators.
Right.
Because your council
for
people
money,
don't
yes.
really have mechanisms of power that they can really impact the school system the way that your state legislators can. And so it's one of those things where it's like, if you're looking for a council person's record on education – you're not going to get a whole lot of anything that's going to tell you much by way of votes. Now, there may be things they do and they advocate for. Maybe there are certain programs they advocate for, or certain things that they model in the schools in their district that tell you what they think about education. But because they're not in a position to impact education policy, you're not going to get much of anything substantive by way of votes about what a council person thinks about education.
But it can be anecdotal. I mean, when I think about a council person representing me, I mean, I live in District 3. I want to know if that council person has children.
Mm-hmm.
Do you send your children
right.
to the schools in our district?
Yep.
Because if you do not, then that means that you're not putting a lot of stock in our schools. Now, you may not have a vote in mm-hmm. terms of trying to figure out the money, but that does tell me you know something that's going
exactly. on. Exactly. And that's a great question, and that's one of those things where that's not something you get on a voter roll.
Yeah, you can't find that out.
Right.
And I know people are loath to tell you where they send their kids to school. I get that. I don't tell where my sons go to school either, but the question is, and I've asked this question to Dr. Sonia Santelises, hey, you don't have to tell me where your child goes to school. I want to know that. But do you send your child to the school to a school in the city.
Mm-hmm.
And if your child does go to a school, is it a public school? Is it a citywide school, which is also public, but it's a different type of rigor?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it an independent school?
Mm-hmm.
Because that does say something. If you're a councilman or a councilwoman and your child's in private school, that's telling me that you're saying there's no school, no public school acceptable in the city that you would send. You'd rather pay the $20,000 to $25,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
And I get it, but it's not on the voting record.
Right.
It is anecdotal, but don't you think that gives me some insight into where you see what's happening?
That's one of the things that we said in the report card we did on the state legislators, you know, this last cycle, is that we used the voting record, but we used a variety of things. We looked at comments they made in committee hearings.
Right.
We looked at amendments that they proposed on certain bills. We looked at things that they said in the press. We looked at events and stuff that they supported and attended. So we looked at the voting record, which is one of many things we looked at to determine the grades for the legislators that we graded.
So Jack Young, got to talk about him, because according to this list, again, arbitrary, folks, put out by Dr. Lawrence Brown, which is using as, you know, just as a starting point across the board.
Mm-hmm.
Every single issue in these three that are supposed to be social justice and racial equity issues, he voted in the opposite direction.
Right. So this is what I got to say about Council President Jack Young. So,
yes.
You know, it's interesting because over the years, you know, we've had disagreements as a matter of policy.
Mm-hmm.
He's been really good about the Baltimore City Children and Youth Fund, you know, which is really an unprecedented approach to grant making in Baltimore City.
Right.
Him and I actually had a really great conversation in City Hall about the mandatory minimums. And it was one of those things where, like, he disagreed, but we were able to have a conversation about, you know, criminal justice. And what he actually said to me when we had the conversation was he says, look, you know, I disagree with you. I get that, you know, you have a certain perspective and you're going to be in Annapolis kind of fighting for that perspective. He said, look, if you feel that strongly about it, I'm not going to show up and advocate on the other side of you. You know what I mean? And so it's one of those things where even though him and I agree to disagree about that, it's one of those things where, because I think sometimes people confuse that with like the FOP.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
It's like, I want to treat a conversation with Council President Jack Young as we have a conversation about something we disagree about versus the FOP, which is an institution that like they have an interest in many ways, empowering police in ways that undermine Black people. And so, again, that's why I said earlier, there are a bunch of other things that you would want to put on the list, because I imagine if you do that, some of the people that are high up might go down and some of the people that are low might go up.
And then that's why you have to do the information.
Right.
Is LBS planning to do a report card? Or maybe I'm asking for a report card for the council members in Baltimore City. I mean, we have an election coming up. We know Zeke Cohen has already kicked off his reelection campaign. So it's that season.
Mm-hmm.
People need a report card, because who's going to do what you say? Even though I think that's a wonderful idea and I urge people to do it, I wonder how many people are actually going to go back and look at the voting records, listen to them, watch the very boring committee hearings, so I can figure out where my council person, who may or may not speak, where they stand on this issue. But a report card from LBS would be taken with a lot of weight and gravity, because it'll do that kind of intellectual work that maybe people don't have time to do.
So we've considered it. We're definitely going to do one for the 2022 cycle, and I'll be honest with you and your listeners, whether we do one in 2020 will be, you know, reliant on if we have the resources to do it.
Okay.
It's really a question of having the resources to do it.
Okay, we need to get the resources for that. We have Leo Burrows on the phone. Leo, how are you? I know you chimed in early, but you have something, some information you wanted to share. So
well, yeah, I just wanted to say something very briefly.
Yes,
Davon,
sir.
Love, keep up the good work. We love you.
Yes, sir.
Listen, I'm interested in integrity on the part of city council people and all elected officials. And sometimes people think integrity is a ham sandwich. It is not. And it's not a nuanced anything. Do they have the courage of their convictions? Where does this council, city council, line up? I know that Jack Young and the mayor, I'm usually on opposite sides, with the Greater Baltimore Committee, the Baltimore Development Corporation in this city. I'm looking at the water bills. How do they get away with not demanding that the not-for-profit corporations, and whether it's Johns Hopkins and others, not pay their fair share, given the fact they owe millions of dollars, and this is a travesty as relates to homeowners and taxpayers and everybody else, let alone the minimum wage, let alone the fact that these city council people...
Okay, I got to stop you there, Leo. I really appreciate you. Now, Dave, I'm going to have you answer that with another question.
Mm-hmm.
Could you, in the last 30 seconds or so, maybe a minute, talk about the Hopkins gun bill. Because I think that's important. I don't want to let that go.
Yeah.
And I appreciate Leo's comment, but I
absolutely
can't let the gun bill go.
So I'm going to tie that in because I think what Mr. Burroughs is talking about, and this is something that's going to sound controversial, but there is a colonial relationship between the largely white corporate business community and Black Baltimore. And unfortunately, that has impacted the nature of our political arrangement because they have disproportionate power. So right now in the Maryland General Assembly, Johns Hopkins is trying to get a private police force. And they've been able to use their resources and power to be able to essentially steamroll this bill through the General Assembly without really making sure that there is consensus about whether or not this private police force should even exist or be authorized. And so I think to Mr. Burroughs' point, we have to demand that elected officials really stand up and challenge this colonial white supremacist relationship that the white-led corporate business community has with Baltimore and make sure that they're not continuing to really buy out elected officials in the ways that they've been able to in the past to really secure their interest and put Baltimore in the condition that it's in.
All right, Davon Love from Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, I appreciate you as always, sir.
Yeah, thank
you. We're
going
to be following up because maybe if they don't produce a report card, maybe you can come on the air and you can just give us a report card and we could talk about it and try to do some of the hard work as well. This is Today with Dr. K. I'm Dr. K. Wise Wyatt. The show is produced by Justine Apollo. We had Dre Melton on the board. Folks, make an appointment. Meet me back here tomorrow at 3 p.m. Let's have another conversation that matters. We can change this city. Why don't we do it block by block and everybody participates? Stay tuned because up next is For the Culture with Faraji. I appreciate you and I'm honored and privileged to be here. Thank you so much.